Hello all, and welcome back to day two of the Federalist Society's Kentucky Chapters Conference. I'm Carmine Icarino, one of the Central Kentucky Chapters officers, and on behalf of each of the Kentucky chapters, we're pleased you are joining us for our final discussion on national injunctions. Before introducing you to the panel this afternoon, I will briefly note that the Federalist Society intends to seek CLE approval for each of these panels, so please be on the lookout for a future email containing more information. And one other note, if you registered for the in-person reception and happy hour this evening, we look forward to seeing you at Spindletop Hall, where we'll hear from United States Court of Appeals judge and Kentucky native, Justin Reed Walker. Finally, I'm pleased to introduce you to this panel on national injunctions. Certainly, it's undeniable that national injunctions have played an increasingly important role in the life of our nation. And with today's discussion, we'll be asked to consider whether that's a positive or a negative development. To help each of us reach a conclusion on that question, I would encourage you as the audience to ask questions using the Q&A feature at the bottom of your screens. And those questions will be posed to our panelists by Judge Van Tatenhove at the close of this discussion. And to moderate this debate, I will turn this over to Judge Gregory F. Van Tatenhove of the United States District Court for the Eastern District of Kentucky. Judge?
Well, thank you very much, Carmine. It's great to join everybody virtually this afternoon. And Paul and Misha, I'm really pleased to be with both of you. We'll dispense with the formalities of introductions simply because those detailed bios are part of everybody's virtual materials. And you have those in front of you, and we want to get right to the substance of our discussion today. It's an interesting week, a ritual that happens from time to time in the body politic is taking place in Washington, D.C. This week. I've described it a little bit like kabuki theater. There's really lots of drama, lots of posturing, but nobody's much in doubt in terms of how things are going to turn out. One of the things I've been struck by this week is the reminder of what an important civics lesson the confirmation process is really for the country. Senator Ben Sasse, in his introductory remarks, in fact, said, I'm going to give a civics lesson to begin with, and then I'm going to talk about the substance of this particular confirmation. But it's been a focused week of discussion on the role of the judiciary in our government and the proper role of a judge. And really our topic today focuses on drawing those lines and trying to decide exactly the power that a judge has, and particularly in the context of injunctive relief, to impose a remedy, and the breadth of that remedy, which says a lot about the breadth of the power of the judiciary. So, Paul, I'm going to begin with you, and I know the department's given this a lot of thought, as my understanding is the department has some national guidance which they provided. They've kind of articulated a particular position that they asked their government lawyers to take across the nation. So why don't you begin? Give us a feel for the department's position.
Sure. Thank you very much, Your Honor, and thank you, Misha, for joining us. And thank you, Carmine and Tom Travis and Kate for helping to put this together. What the judge just said about a guidance is accurate. There's a memorandum from Attorney General Sessions from September 13th, 2018, as the judge just said, essentially instructing attorneys at the Department of Justice, all things being equal, of course, with attentiveness to local precedent, to resist nationwide injunctions and to argue against them. There are a number of grounds for this, and I don't want to be sort of encyclopedic about this. So what I'd like to do is just emphasize one or two, maybe three reasons for resisting the concept of a nationwide injunction. And I will take a leaf from Judge Van Tatenhove's book here, the confirmation hearings, and much of the focus of the confirmation hearings is on the virtues of originalism, what originalism means, and why it's a good thing. And I think that we can start from there. So when Congress enacted the Judiciary Act in 1789 to start off the federal courts, it had in mind, at least with respect to equitable relief, the Court of Chancery in London and what it would typically do. And so as an originalist matter, not so much as a constitutional matter per se, but as a statutory matter, what we're asking ourselves here is what would Chancery have thought itself capable of doing in 1789? And that's largely a matter of affording relief to the parties before it. And so unless a class were formed of every single person in the United States who had standing and could claim injury in fact and so on for relief, a nationwide injunction would be inappropriate because it would not be responsive to the actual case in front of the judge. And connecting this up with the constitutional arguments, as we know from going all the way back to Marbury and Madison, federal courts exist to hear cases and controversies, and their predicate for action is a case or controversy that comes before them. And so the relief that they properly can afford, again, is defined in terms of the individuals who appear before the court and can allege properly injury in fact, causation, and redressability. So with those statutory and constitutional constraints on the authority of the judiciary in mind, nationwide injunctions are almost always problematic from the point of view both of the statute and of the Constitution. I will add one thing, and we can leave everything else for a later conversation or for questions, and that is that the negative implication of the concept of a class action is that you can't do it casually. There are rules under, as we all know, complicated rules about the proper formation of a class, and those rules would become essentially superfluous if a single plaintiff could obtain a nationwide injunction without going through the rigor of properly defining a class and having that class certified by a court of law. So again, I have more to say in defense of the Department of Justice's position, but I think that probably is enough to set the table, Your Honor, if that would be sufficient for now.
That sounds like a good start. Well, Misha, give us the countervailing view as to the appropriateness of national injunctions.
Thank you so much, Your Honor, and thank you to the Federal Society and Paul for this, putting this together. In my respectful submission, nationwide injunctions, or at least injunctions that go to a particular circuit or much broader than the individual plaintiff before the court, are absolutely necessary to safeguard the rule of law and the separation of powers. The attorneys general, back when President Obama was president, secured many nationwide injunctions blocking many illegal actions that President Obama had taken on a nationwide scale. And adopting anything like the U.S. Department of Justice position now would have led to cascading illegality for months, if not years, from policies that are plainly illegal and unconstitutional. Now, with that in mind, I'd like to make two brief points today. First, why the wholesale critique of nationwide injunctions is not correct as a matter of principle, and second, why the real problem with nationwide injunctions is forum shopping and how that can be addressed through other means. But given that Paul kept his comments fairly short, I might leave that second part for later discussion. Now, first, why is the wholesale critique of nationwide injunctions incorrect in my respectful submission? First, I think that if one looks at the arguments of the critics of nationwide injunctions, you'll see that they almost all admit to numerous exceptions to this rule, which I think goes to establish the point that there is no principled basis against all nationwide injunctions, and rather it is a prudential argument that ultimately cashes out to just district courts should be careful and thoughtful when they do something like a nationwide injunction or a circuit-wide injunction, not that there is some sort of originalist or per se bar. First, I think almost all critics of nationwide injunctions agree that a single district judge could issue a nationwide injunction in a 23B2 class action. Now, the rules of 23B2 are not grounded in the Constitution. They are rules that the Supreme Court has enacted as part of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. So I think any concession that a 23B2 nationwide class action is appropriate, I think eliminates most of the Article 3 critiques and other originalist critiques of nationwide injunctions. Second, most critics agree that if you have a membership organization, like the U.S. Chamber, challenging a nationwide rule, there you really do need to have a nationwide injunction to give an organization like the U.S. Chamber full relief, because of course it has members all over the country, and it would be impossible to give the U.S. Chamber effective relief without issuing effectively a nationwide injunctions. Third, many critics concede that nationwide injunctions are appropriate in the context of rule challenges because the APA's text itself authorizes federal courts to set aside rules. And the DC Circuit, of course, often sets aside rules on a nationwide basis without limiting the relief somehow to just the District of Columbia or just the parties in front of the court. In fact, that's the vast majority of what the DC Circuit does in environmental cases that come before it. And the DC Circuit example highlights a further category where most folks, I think, concede nationwide injunctions are permissible, where Congress sets a exclusive venue to litigate a particular dispute. There, since the venue is exclusive, most folks recognize that nationwide injunctions in that context are inevitable. So given all of these, I think most of them universally, some of them largely recognized basis where nationwide injunctions are appropriate, I think the ultimate question here is a matter of prudence and how far should courts go in the appropriate context, given the nationwide or non-nationwide scope of the rule at issue, the logical consequences of what would happen if the injunction created a patchwork where a certain federal rule or a certain federal statute applied in some states but not others, to some citizens but not others. And so since this is ultimately a prudential question, it's really a sliding scale. And I think that where one lands on that sliding scale should ultimately turn on where someone thinks the greater threat to the separation of powers is. Is the greater threat in the modern context to the separation of powers a unilateral executive, like President Obama showed, taking advantage of legal loopholes to try to implement as much illegal policy as possible before enough lawsuits are brought to stop it? Or is the bigger threat to separation of powers overreaching federal district courts that take it upon themselves to decide issues for the entire country when there are lots of lawsuits being brought? I would respectfully submit that this is an issue of judgment and values, and it's a sliding scale depending on the particular claimed illegal policy at issue, and it's not amenable to any bright line solution either for nationwide injunctions or against nationwide injunctions. And the final thing that I would say is a per se bright line adoption of an anti-nationwide injunction rule would be something that I think would be deeply disruptive and destructive to the separation of powers and federalism. Because of course, the decisions that the executive makes are an iterative process, often based on what they think they can survive in court. And as we saw with the way that President Obama used federal standing law to try to enact many illegal rules on the thesis that no one's gonna have standing to challenge them in court, including rewriting the Affordable Care Act in multiple ways. If the federal courts, especially the US Supreme Court, were to adopt a no nationwide injunction rule as a bright line rule, an executive that wanted to enact illegal policies would surely take advantage of this on the notion that, hey, one district court here, one district court there will stop it for one or two plaintiffs. But meanwhile, my illegal policy will be able to be implemented across the country while this works up its way up to the Supreme Court for as long as that takes, over 2 years.
So let me ask you this, Misha. part of me reacts to your argument by saying, generally feeling like your argument is based on the notion that nationwide injunctions should exist because good things can result when that tool is available to a judge. It's necessary in some ways. But I'm wrestling a little bit with what is the principle that we can rest on to make sure that that isn't mostly just a discretionary act on the behalf of a judge, as opposed to a principled application of maybe what prudential notions of case and controversy, standing, mootness, those things that we typically look at in order to limit the power of federal judges.
No, that's a really good question. And I mean, it is a problem with just equity jurisdiction in general, you know, where there are unfortunately almost no bright line rules in equity. And I do think that the Supreme Court should set up important guideposts to district courts in guiding their equity. I do think that injunctions that go beyond a particular circuit should be rarely used because, you know, it precludes the development of circuit splits and percolations of issues. And so that is an important guidepost that I think the U.S. Supreme Court should set out as an equitable consideration. Another important equitable consideration should be how truly interactive is the rule on a nationwide basis. And here I'm thinking about the Obama administration's redefinition of the scope of the Clean Water Act in its waters rule. And that rule is meant to govern interstate waters. And what happened when a bunch of district courts heeded the Department of Justice view that we shouldn't have nationwide injunctions is that this rule that was supposed to govern interstate waters had different, was applied or not applied, active or not active, just depending on which state happened to have brought the lawsuit. The end result of that regime was such an irrational rule that the EPA could have never adopted it and passed arbitrary and capricious rulemaking because it made no, you would never adopt a WOTUS rule that applied to a body of water that bordered another state and applied on one or the other. And so basically what the courts did in adopting the anti-nationwide injunction approach in the WOTUS rule is in fact, in its essence, enact a new rule which no agency had ever adopted, which no agency would adopt, that created a patchwork in a nationwide rule. And I think in that context, it was a mistake for the courts to do that. However, in other contexts where a rule really does not interact across state lines and it can really be cabined to the impact within a particular state or a particular district, I think a nationwide injunction would be wholly inappropriate.
Thank you, Misha. Well, Paul, I want you to respond to this argument and particularly focus on whether or not the departmental position changes if the focus is on a smaller geographic area. So the notion of a single district judge binding the country with a nationwide injunction it feels problematic on a lot of different levels. But what about a decision that's bound to a circuit or bound to a district as a way of effectuating the injunctive relief?
And I, if I might, Your Honor, I might start from a municipality, if you don't mind.
No, please.
So one of the arguments that's made in defense of broader injunctions than the plaintiff is, you know, what if someone says, I wasn't admitted to such and such a school because of my race, like Ms. Brown in Brown versus the Board, and let's just assume for the sake of argument that she doesn't sue on behalf of a class, exactly how do you desegregate a municipal educational system without granting an injunction that goes beyond simply allowing that one person to go to school? And I think that there's a fair amount of precedent that suggests that when there's close affinity or, you know, discernible affinity between not so much just the party's plaintiff, but people who are closely identified with the party's plaintiff, that the courts will go ahead and grant an injunction that gathers all of those imaginable parties plaintiff and grants relief on their behalf. I bracket that because I don't think the Department of Justice would object in the same way. I suspect, however, that The ease of forming a 23B2 class is so readily apparent that in a way that's a purely academic notion. I mean, at this point, any good civil rights attorney would know to form a 23B2 and therefore should do that. And so I start from there. Once you get up to the state and the circuit, Your Honor, I'm not so sure that the arguments work anymore. I do understand that, at least at the level, I mean, there are two districts in Kentucky, at least at the level of the District of Kentucky, there might be some question about how stare decisis works in that particular district and so on. And so it might be the same anyway to have a district-wide injunction. But as you emanate out from a municipality, the arguments that I believe I made earlier tend to control more and more. If I may, and I don't know if I've answered your question just yet, Your Honor, but if I may, I'd like to respond to one point that Misha made, if I may, but perhaps please. I haven't answered your question yet.
No, please do.
So Misha, I think, made a telling and important argument about WOTUS. I agree with him that's at least as a Platonic matter, no way to run a railroad. Water is not mindful of interstate boundaries, or at least not necessarily, is I guess the way I should put it. And therefore, there can be a substantial amount of irrationality in having two sets of rules defining what constitutes waters of the United States in those particular contexts. But in a way, I think Misha's argument points to the value and this links up with the concept of separation of powers, which he rightfully emphasizes. Congress got ahead of this problem with the Clean Air Act, which I'm sure Misha knows very well. With Section 307, Congress said, if EPA comes up with a rule on the Clean Air Act, you have 60 days to bring your attack in the D.C. Circuit, or you're forever subject to that rule. Thus, we have a consolidated, unified attack in the D.C. Circuit that's relatively time-barred and has proper focus from the court. And then, of course, there's just one step from there to the Supreme Court. If I were the advisor to Senator Murkowski, I might say, hey, maybe you should consider having nationwide jurisdiction for our tax on rules under the Clean Water Act, because look, it works pretty well in the context of the Clean Air Act, and it's a formalist response to one of the best defenses of the nationwide injunction, which otherwise is a formalist rule that I would defend from the other perspective. So Congress has weighed in, as Misha, I'm sure, knows, with the Clean Air Act, and it's been doing that actually for a long time. Those of you who love legal history know that the Emergency Price Control Act of 1942 required people who wanted to complain about retail beef prices to bring their complaint within 60 days of the promulgation of the order, and led to the Lockerty and Yackas cases from 1943 and 1944, upholding that sort of centralized view. So it's an old device, and I would encourage Congress to look at that in the specific context that I think Misha points out is and was highly problematic.
So a point of agreement. Sorry, go ahead, Your Honor.
No, please.
I agree entirely with what Paul just said. I think, as I kind of previewed at the beginning, I think the real problem with nationwide injunctions is this notion of forum shopping. And, if President Trump, enacts, someone on the questions put a travel ban, and everybody knows which court to go to, and, there's a possibility to get a nationwide injunction, and, the shoe's on the other foot, and likely will be on the other foot pretty soon. But if Congress were to enact the kind of provision that Paul discussed, and the kind that it has done in the Clean Air Act context, and the kind that it has done in certain other contexts, whether it's assigning the case exclusively to the D.C. Circuit, or like they have in other provisions where there's a lottery, where it goes to any circuit where a petition for review has been filed within 10 days of the formalization of the rule, it would then go to a single court of appeals or a single three-judge court. All the interested parties could meet there, and you would not have almost all of the problems of the nationwide injunctions that the Department of Justice properly identified. And that is, I think, the ultimate solution legislatively to that. The problem, of course, is here, Congress is not likely to enact something like that. Maybe they'd enact it for the Clean Water Act, but overall. So I think the challenge for us in a situation where that does not exist is, what do we do in the world where there isn't that kind of statute for the vast majority of actions a president or his administrative agencies could take? And I think that's the real challenge.
Isn't that the role of class actions, though? Isn't that, in large measure, the answer here? If you want relief that is broader and continues to be consistent with the notion of providing relief to the litigants that are before you, as opposed to binding individuals or entities that aren't before you, there is, as you point out, there's a rule that allows you to do that in a way to kind of have a broader impact. Doesn't that, in essence, solve that problem?
Well, I think the class action mechanism actually, in some ways, keeps the worst aspects of nationwide injunctions without the benefits, because the real, like, as I mentioned, I think the real problem with nationwide injunctions is this forum shopping problem. And what happens if you feed it all through the extant 23B2 mechanism is that you just have forum shopping to a particular district court, and you know, folks would go there, and that district court would get to decide who's lead counsel, and we get to control policy for the whole nation. So I don't think that the class action mechanism, as currently represented in the rule of civil procedure, cures the most fundamental defect with nationwide injunctions as I see it. But it certainly does deal with some of the other aspects of it, that is, inconsistent injunctions or the fact that the government has to run the table.
Your Honor and Misha, I think this is kind of fun. We seem to be reaching closure on a number of things. The fact that class actions don't solve the problems that nationwide injunctions present, I don't think is an indictment of class actions per se. I agree with Misha, though, that deserves attention, and he's right that forum shopping is not eliminated. What eliminates forum shopping is either centralized review as per the Clean Air Act or some vehicle like that, or MDL. And I'm a very big fan of enhanced MDL. And so I think, again, if I were an advisor to Senator Graham, I might emphasize that to him. And so I think that Misha and I probably agree about far more than we disagree about. I agree that the idea of having a party's plaintiff pick their forum, pick their attorney, pick their issue, not so much pick their issue, obviously that's what plaintiffs do, but pick their forum and then pick their attorney, and then depending on how successful they are, dictate national policy from their perspective of one district is problematic. I completely agree with that. I think there are other solutions. I go back to an argument that I made earlier when I used the word formalist. I tend to be a formalist. And so by and large, I'm not comfortable with sliding scales and trust me rules. I admire Justice Brennan, or admired him as a human being, but I tended not to like his jurisprudence. I tended to like the jurisprudence of Justice Scalia. You know, a lot of rules, formal rules, maybe with formal exceptions. I see the case or controversy requirements of Article 3 as being a formalist rule, and I see the limits of the Judiciary Act of 1789 as being formalist rules, and I see 23B2 as being a set of formalist rules that are intended to comply with the statute in the Constitution. I'm uncomfortable with a rule that goes, or an approach that goes much beyond that. So I think addressing an important adjective that Misha used earlier, he described these as prudential rules. I tend not to be fond of prudential rules of jurisprudence, simply because they, to my mind, they're often neither here nor there. So I think that's where we might disagree, but on the formal principles, I don't really see a lot of disagreement between Misha and myself.
Far be it for me to end up on the wrong side of a Justice Scalia, Justice Brennan comparison. And I'll just say that you know, Justice Scalia upheld or would have upheld many nationwide injunctions blocking clearly illegal actions, not least of which was his dissent, his joining the joint dissent in the Obamacare case in NFIB versus Sebelius in 2012. You know, it would be hard to imagine how, you know, 100 million people would have needed to bring that lawsuit for Justice Scalia to have reached the conclusion that a statute that clearly illegal should not govern the lives of Americans. So I certainly wouldn't accept that my view is more in line with Justice Brennan than with Justice Scalia.
Let me ask whether either of you have kind of taken a look at the potential of the Supreme Court maybe weighing in on this issue. They really haven't, despite the controversy in recent years, they've not yet taken on kind of providing that kind of guidance that maybe would be helpful in this particular area. Either of you see any prospect in this term, or you think the court will take this matter up? And if they do, what's that going to look like?
I mean, I do think that the Supreme Court is going to need to address this issue. Likely, it will come up in the context of, in my political prediction, you know, illegal actions taken by the Biden administration. And I think that the Supreme Court is going to be setting out, unfortunately, Paul, prudential principles that cabin the issuance of nationwide injunctions to important guideposts rather than forbidding them across the board. I think that's consistent with how the court generally operates, and I would be quite surprised if they were to adopt a more bright line approach. But I've been surprised by the court before.
I'm inclined to, as a predictive matter, Misha, and this is me just, you know, thinking out loud. It's not me speaking on behalf of the Department of Justice in any formal way. I can see Chief Justice Roberts being Chief Justice Roberts. And not coming up with anything particularly hard and fast simply because it's not necessary to resolve the case. And if that's what you're saying, I can see that. And I can see him also seeing this as a matter for the court as an institution, and therefore a matter where he really will feel responsible for holding the pen as opposed to delegating it. And if that's the case, then I'm inclined to agree with you. If I were a betting man, I would put my money on where you just put it.
Well, Misha, with the phrase Biden administration, your predictions are even broader than just simply on what the court might do. I don't know if you're making a prediction about the outcome of the election or not, but
I am. I can read the polls. I know folks, you know, are skeptical about the polls, but I mean, this is one of the reasons I care so much about this issue, and why, you know, I've wanted to speak on it, is that, you know, frankly, I feel like sometimes our side of this debate is self-defeating and self-owns, and you know, we've seen what's happened with nationwide injunctions over the last couple of years, and I was concerned that if the Federalist Society folks kind of adopted as a matter, as a kind of a canon of our faith, this anti-nationwide injunction approach, that it would open up a giant loophole for the Biden administration to make the Obama administration seem modest in adopting wholesale illegal rules because they can't get legislation, or maybe legislation if they kill a filibuster, on the notion that, hey, they're not going to get 100 million lawsuits, and we'll be able to get 60% of the compliance from our illegal rule. We'll be able to kill off, you know, 40% of the power plants. We'll be able to do this and that before the issue ultimately gets to the way of the Supreme Court. And if I believed that originalism dictated that outcome, I would say, so be it. But because I don't believe originalism dictates that outcome, I'm very concerned that that a lot of people in our movement, in the Federal Society movement, are adopting a position that will be self-defeating to the separation of powers. And that's my concern.
Yeah, so develop a little bit more this notion that originalism doesn't doesn't support that particular position. What do you mean? What do you mean by that? When you say that, what are you saying?
I mean, as I study the literature on this, you know, when I read the case law, you know, back in the Court of Chancery with the bills of peace and things of that sort, I see analogs to a nationwide injunction. And certainly bills of peace were not issued with anywhere near the regularity that nationwide injunctions are issued. But I think that might be a notion that the current executive just does so many more things nationwide than anything that the executive did, you know, back at the time where the bills of peace were allowed and were used, you know, at least with some regularity. And so as the scope of nationwide actions by the executive increases, I think a tool comparable to the bills of peace is certainly permissible as an originalist matter. And so since it's permissible as originalist matter, I think it's more of a notion of what are the statutes that Congress has adopted that guide this, and what are the other limits on equitable jurisdiction that the Supreme Court will articulate.
Paul, what do you think about that, kind of that argument?
Well, I appreciate Misha bringing up bills of peace. I think of bills of peace as an example of, you know, I'm being beset by all of these people who are suing me on the same theory. Bills of peace actually more readily map onto parties defendant as opposed to parties plaintiff, you know, a class of defendants. All of these people should leave me alone. A little bit like a quiet title action, actually. But I return to my formalist principles. I take Misha's point about how an adverse administration might try to take advantage of a prohibition on nationwide injunctions, but that's why God created mandamus and prohibition. And as I'm sure Misha knows, when Judge Morris in the District of Montana, on the basis of the Endangered Species Act and the Clean Water Act and Nationwide Permit 12 enjoined Nationwide Permit 12 on a nationwide basis, pretty quickly the Supreme Court said no and cut that back. So I think that there are opportunities for prohibition and mandamus working properly to help stay in front of that. Now, Misha's probably going to say that, you know, that's a lot to put you're putting a lot of hope on a relatively unavailable strategy, but it's there as a formal matter to address that.
Well, so Paul, let me raise an example that we're dealing with in the state of Wisconsin to kind of show what I am concerned about, even with that mechanism. The Wisconsin Supreme Court about 4 months ago struck down Governor Evers' stay-at-home order. And the governor at first abided by that. But then very recently, with the increase of COVID cases in Wisconsin, the governor just decided, I don't care what the state Supreme Court said, I'm going to do a new stay-at-home order. And so I take it that if we were to import the principles of anti-nationwide injunctions to that kind of circumstance, even though the state Supreme Court has spoken, every single Wisconsinite is now going to need to bring a lawsuit or if, you know, maybe try to certify a class if that's possible, to challenge this plainly illegal rule, which is, I mean, just very, very clearly just thumbing its nose at the state Supreme Court. So even if the case, if a group of plaintiffs brought up that case and it went right to the Wisconsin Supreme Court and the Supreme Court affirmed an injunction, under the principles against nationwide or statewide injunctions, then the governor could say, well, okay, fine, I will follow it for those plaintiffs only, and I'm going to continue to ignore the state Supreme Court, and in this analogy, the U.S. Supreme Court. So sure. That's one of the things I'm worried about.
Sure, and I think that's where the Bill of Peace does catch up with us. And again, I make the analogy of the quiet title action. If, you know, person A comes up and says, Black Acres not yours, and you win, and person B comes up and says, Black Acres not yours, and you win, and there's some affinity between all these people, eventually you can get a bill of peace or a bill of quiet and have them all, essentially it's an instruction to the clerk actually not to accept any more complaints. I get that. And I'm willing to go down that road with you, Misha, and I'm willing to bracket that. As you know, oftentimes to obtain an injunction, you have to show the judge that there's some real imminent danger that something terrible is going to happen. If you've got a governor who kind of flagrantly comes back and keeps doing precisely what the governor is told not to do by the court, I think that would be the predicate for that kind of relief. But I'm going to go ahead and distinguish the president saying or EPA saying, well, that's in the Ninth Circuit. It's not in the Seventh Circuit. I do think that's different. And maybe you don't, but I do think that's different. And that gets to the point of percolation, which we haven't talked about, but I think you hinted at earlier.
You know, I agree with that entirely. And I think that it would be wise for, and I see that we see this in some of the more recent practice, for any injunctions to be limited to particular circuits to allow for that kind of percolation. I think that is a very good thing. And I think absent extraordinary circumstances, that is the approach that should be taken within each circuit.
Let me remind everybody that you have the Q&A function available to you if you have questions for our panelists this afternoon. And we've got a couple of questions. Let me just throw them out for you both, Senator, and they kind of help kind of frame how perplexing this can be in some ways. So one of the questions is, it says, most states have multiple U.S. district courts. Kentucky has two, for example. Why should a statewide injunction by the Eastern District of Kentucky be any more valid in the Western District of Kentucky than it would be in Tennessee or in Indiana? Paul, why don't you begin and respond to that?
I couldn't agree with the premise underlying the question more. And I'd go a little bit farther and say, I'm not quite sure why it should even go to the four corners of the Eastern District of Kentucky for the same sort of logical reasons. My general answer is it should protect the plaintiffs. And if the plaintiffs are savvy enough to create a class, then it should protect all members of the class. I would essentially not be cognizant of borders. I did bracket municipalities earlier, first because there's a strong history of that, but secondly because there tends to be a close affinity. But I don't think that the other boundaries described would really be material analytically.
Misha?
Yeah, I mean, if one thinks that as a originalist matter that this is somehow, you know, kind of impermissible, then that obviously stops the conversation whole. But if one doesn't take that position, then I will just say, just think about the Waters rule. You had a rule that governed the meaning of what was the national jurisdiction over waters. And those waters don't care if you're in Eastern Kentucky or in Western Kentucky. And to have a different set of rules for a river that flows across from wherever the Eastern District to wherever the Western District is, I think is just nonsensical to the point of being absurd. So absent a Article 3 basis why that result would need to obtain, I would say that there would be no reason to adopt that kind of approach, at least in a case like that. Of course, if for some reason there was these slate of litigations that the Department of Justice faced over the policy that the federal government had done about defunding certain sanctuary cities. Certainly, in that sort of context, the injunction should only flow to the sanctuary city because it's getting the money or it's not getting the money. And if that sanctuary city is in Eastern Kentucky, why should that affect the Western Kentucky flow of money? So I think the difference between a sanctuary city flow of money situation or a Waters rule situation where you have this interaction on a nationwide rule, I think is the core to the kind of injunctions that should be permitted versus the kind that should not be permitted.
And maybe what's going on in the water cases is it's a recognition that the parties in front of you cannot be provided full relief without a broader injunction, right? I mean, that's the way to think about it in those cases, is that what we're trying to do as judges is we're trying to provide relief to the parties in front of us that have litigated the case, that have Article 3 standing. You have the case in controversy in front of us. But sometimes we can't provide that relief absent it having a broader impact.
Well, to Your Honor, to to take a, you know, some famous WOTUS cases, Rapanos or Sackett and so on. It depends on where the land is. We could posit some land that's in two different judicial districts. It's not impossible to imagine. And where there's this, where in order to obtain relief, the plaintiffs need an injunction, assuming they prevail on the merits, that would have interjurisdictional, interdistrict effect. You're knocking on an open door there. I wouldn't have a problem with it. I think Misha's making more of a doctrinal or Platonic point that it would be odd if a single body of water were governed by two different rules depending on which end of the body of water you're at. As a pure matter of logic, it's not impossible to have two sets of rules. Certainly rivers go from one country to another and are subject to different rules in the two different countries. So it's not metaphysically impossible, but I completely concede, Misha, that that's not the way to run the railroad. As I said earlier, I'd put that to Senator Murkowski, not to a judge.
Well, I have one more question. Let me see if I can parse through this. It says, so a single United States District Court judge can stop the president for such things as national security, such as the travel ban.
Yeah, look, I think probably what's animating that question is probably a substantive disagreement with the challenge to the travel ban. You know, I don't know the individual that asked that question, but I would be surprised if they had the same reaction when a single district judge in Florida enjoined the Obamacare, or when a single judge in Texas enjoined President Obama's attempt to rewrite wholesale immigration laws by giving legal status to 4 million illegal aliens that could travel across state lines. So I think that the crux of that question is probably really aimed at the nature of the travel ban and whether federal courts should be in the business of second guessing a president's foreign policy judgments, as opposed to some of the other issues we've discussed.
Well, we're going to wrap up right at 1 o'clock. So if there are other questions out there, please feel free to weigh in for our panelists. They have covered the field, I think, pretty extensively, but you may have something specific you want to ask, and so now's the time to ask those specific questions before we wrap it up.
Your Honor, I think that just to expand a little bit on Misha's last point, in some ways it really does depend on your perspective on the Constitution. I've often described myself as first and foremost an Article I guy, although I'm now working in the executive branch. But I know that a lot of my friends are Article III people. And if your perspective on the government puts a fair amount of emphasis on Article III, then I think it's hard to resist the argument that the law is a Platonic, you know, ideal, and it's absurd that the Platonic ideal can exist in one part of the country but not elsewhere. If you believe, as I think a lot of us do, that the law is an ideal, and that judges reach that, you know, properly, and I don't mean to be a cynic here, but if that's your perspective, then naturally you would be weirded out by the idea that the right rule would obtain in one place and not everywhere. On the other hand, if you look at it from the perspective of Article I or Article II, with emphasis on Congress or the President, and less emphasis on the courts, you might find yourself having more appreciation for the heterogeneity of a rule applying because one judge in good faith and good conscience comes up with it, or, you know, finds it properly in one place, but others may, with respect, disagree elsewhere, and it percolates up to the Supreme Court, where ultimately a decision is made. I think what I'm saying is that in some respects, the debate about the propriety or impropriety of nationwide injunctions is a surrogate for the debate about whether we can tolerate heterogeneity in law. And I think a lot of people understandably are uncomfortable with that.
So I think there's a lot of wisdom in what Paul just said, and I will try to amend it to fit my concerns. I'm definitely an Article One, guy. I'm very skeptical of executive power. And I think the greatest threat, while perhaps at one point the greatest threat to the separation of powers was an overreaching judiciary, I think in the modern world, the greatest threat to the separation of powers and our freedoms is a unilateral, overreaching executive. And I worry about the adoption of bright line rules that give that executive, already far overpowered, well beyond anything that the founders envisioned, a new loophole to do more. And the experience of litigating against President Obama was a really formative experience for me. Where he took, well-meaning Article III standing rules and used them as loopholes to fundamentally change law on the, explicit notion that no one's going to have standing to challenge this, so I'll be able to get away with it for 4, 5, 6 years. If I thought that Article III required that result, I would co-sign with Paul in a second. But I worry that in a world where Article I has been sidelined, and the conversation is really beyond between Article 2 and Article 3, that Article 3, and especially those who agree with our principles, unilaterally disarming, will not redound to the benefit of the separation of powers, but will only redound to the benefit of Article 2, and thus against the rule of law and against the separation of powers.
It's interesting in Kentucky, the pandemic and the lawsuits which have arisen out of the pandemic have given rise to a circumstance that happens from time to time where district court judges reach different conclusions about the constitutionality, for example, of particular provisions. Certainly happened in a case that I had in which there were two Kentucky judges. We both district court judges. We looked at similar issues and we reached different conclusions. And as I noted in my opinion, that happens. That's kind of the way the law formulates sometimes. I'm not going to have the final word. The final word's more likely going to be with the Sixth Circuit in that particular case. And it's the circuit then that, in essence, decides on what the rule is for that particular geographic area. This leads to another question we receive, which is this: the availability of an immediate interlocutory appeal as to any injunction mitigates the problem. Why is that not enough?
Well, since I'm generally on the other side of this debate, but I do think that it probably doesn't fix the problem entirely, because the issue is the federal government has to run the table, and you get 30 lawsuits asking for nationwide injunctions from 30 handpicked districts, and then you lose the federal government, you lose 20 of those, and then you've got to run up to each court of appeals, and if you don't bat 1,000, your potentially perfectly legal policy is enjoined nationwide. And that's why I do think that even though as a matter of principle, I very strongly oppose any bright line prohibition on nationwide injunctions, the Supreme Court needs to step in and give clear guidelines and limitations to this practice, because that kind of thing and having the federal government or a state government have to run up every single time is just not that's not a way to run a railroad either.
Paul, any final observations, sir?
No, it's always gratifying to hear opposing counsel, so to speak, make the last paragraph of one's argument. Thanks, Misha. I was talking about, I said that's why God created prohibition and mandamus, but Misha's pointing out the practical difficulty of that. And he also points out that if nationwide injunctions are the norm, which thank goodness they're not, The government has to win every single case, because if it loses a single case, it's subject to a nationwide injunction. It's lopsided. If the government wins, one plaintiff has to stand down. But if the plaintiff wins, then the government loses across the country. And if there are 100 lawsuits, it's like a ship. You know, one torpedo can take the ship down if the hole's big enough.
Well, gentlemen, thank you very much for your time this afternoon. Misha, I think we promised to get you freed up by 1 o'clock, and we're just a couple of minutes now before that time. I don't think there's any question that this conversation is going to continue as a matter of the public debate in the near future with some vigor behind it, because it will continue to be an issue, and it very well may be that a Biden administration is continuing to force these issues. So, Paul, it's good to see you, friend. Thank you very much for your participation. Misha, thank you for taking the time today to be part of this as well.
Thank you so much, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Just a reminder to everyone, the reception is planned for this evening at Spindletop Hall. I think Carmine had mentioned that. Carmine, I don't know if you are still with us. You have anything final? If not, we'll just sign off. And thanks to everybody for participating today.
Thank you to Judge Van Tatenhove and to Paul and Misha. You all have a good day.
Thanks. Thanks, everybody.